From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air. Think back on the 1988 presidential race. What do you remember? George Bush was accused of being a wimp, Gary Hart was caught in a scandal, and Michael Dukakis supposedly let Willie Horton go free. Coming up, we meet journalist Roger Smith. His book about the 88 campaign is Roadshow. Smith says the campaign may be behind us, but we're still feeling its effects. Also today, we meet writer Ruth Sidransky. Her memoir, In Silence, is about growing up a hearing child of deaf parents. World music critic Milo Miles samples some of the great bossa nova music from Brazil. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the classic animated film Fantasia. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House today praised the government of South Africa for lifting the state of emergency in the strife-torn Natal province. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The announcement came in a written statement from the president's spokesman, Marlon Fitzwater, who called the development, quote, another important landmark on the road toward full normalization of political activity in South Africa, end quote. The statement goes on to praise South African President F.W. de Klerk for his political courage and leadership. The lifting of the state of emergency in Natal is important in Washington because it moves Pretoria closer to complying with the conditions set for revoking economic sanctions against South Africa. Those conditions were established by Congress in 1986. South Africa has complied with almost all the conditions, but it still has yet to resolve the status of some 2,000 to 3,000 political prisoners. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Panamanian officials claim today that they've uncovered an apparent plot to overthrow the U.S.-backed government of President Guillermo Endara. The president's office issued a statement saying that the coup was to start with the takeover of a northwestern province by rebel police units. A senior police official who was arrested in connection with the plot was quoted as saying that it was led by a former national police chief, Colonel Eduardo Herrera. Herrera was retired last August. The takeover was reportedly scheduled to begin yesterday, but was frustrated by loyalist police officers. Testimony continued to be taken today by the official Israeli commission appointed to investigate the bloody riot in Jerusalem on October 8th, when at least 21 Palestinians were killed in Muslim holy places by Israeli police. Patricia Golan reports that the police and the paramilitary border police have been placing the blame on each other.
Jerusalem City police commanders today pointed a finger at the border police, a branch of the Israel army, who they said deployed a unit of 45 men on the Temple Mount without the knowledge of police. The commanders said it was standard policy never to station police contingents on the mount, the site of the Al-Aqsa and Dome of the Rock mosques, to avoid provoking Arab worshippers. The commanders, whose jobs are on the line once the commission's findings are published, say the presence of the border police unit was a main cause of the rioting, and it was those troops who opened fire with live ammunition and caused the high number of casualties. The border police has rejected these claims, saying the police was notified of the patrol on the mount early the morning of the clash. The commission is expected to hand its conclusions to the prime minister at the end of next week. National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
An emergency meeting of the Arab League broke up today after the Palestine Liberation Organization led a walkout. The PLO stormed out of the meeting after losing a vote to condemn the United States' response to last week's shooting of 21 Palestinians by Israeli security forces. The resolution failed by one vote. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 65 points today to close at 2,452.72. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. My guest today has called the electoral process the longest-running roadshow in American history. And ever since the 1976 presidential campaign, when Jimmy Carter came out of relative obscurity to beat the incumbent Gerald Ford, journalist Roger Simon has been reporting on that show. Simon writes a nationally syndicated column at the Baltimore Sun, and he's just compiled his reflections on the 1988 presidential campaign in the new book, Roadshow. The 88 campaign was the campaign of the Gary Hart-Donna Rice affair, George Bush and the wimp factor, Michael Dukakis playing soldier in a tank, Willie Horton, and the much-caricatured vice presidential candidacy of Dan Quayle. Roger Simon was on the road following the campaign during its entire 22-month run. When we spoke, I wanted to know if anyone is having a good time during these campaigns.
The terrible little secret of campaigns is that we're all having a good time. I, as a reporter covering these things since 1976, was sort of shocked every time the campaign would finish up and the books would come out saying how dreary and awful and what a terrible time it all was. And I would remember going past the bars and going in them during the campaign where all the reporters were sitting and all the operatives were sitting, and occasionally a candidate would wander in. Nobody was crying. We were all laughing. We were having pretty much a good time, which is part of what I tried to convey in the book.
Well, we don't think of Bush or Dukakis as particularly exciting candidates, and yet there's something about the campaign trail that creates its own kind of excitement.
There's the atmosphere that we're special, the players in the game, that we know what's going on, and not only that we know what's going on, but that we know what's going on about something important, the election of a president. And we look upon the world, America, is divided into two groups, the players, which is the candidate, the operatives, the media people, and the press, and the civilians, the great body of the American public, whose only role it is to vote.
Well, the way you talk about the players, it almost sounds like a conspiracy.
It's not a conspiracy in the sense that we sit down and determine what we're going to say the next day and we all say the same thing. Actually, the pack mentality of the press, which we used to read so much about in 1976 and 1980, has broken down somewhat because of the explosion of press people, media people who now cover these events. When I first covered the Jimmy Carter campaign in 1976 in Iowa, where he began, there were four people on his campaign plane. At a similar event in 1988, there were 700 reporters there. So it's hard to keep a conspiracy among that many people, just like it's hard to keep a secret among that many people.
Well, does anything spontaneous happen on the campaign trail? Is there room even built in for a kind of freewheeling encounter? Or is everything kind of orchestrated by the handlers and their candidates?
The handlers hope there is nothing ever spontaneous. The word spontaneous or spontaneity is the word that strikes terror into their hearts. The phrase they use is that they must keep the candidate in the box. And the worst thing that can happen is for the candidate to get out of the box, to actually speak what's on his mind, or to be found in his Capitol Hill townhouse with Donna Rice in the case of Gary Hart.
We'll get to that, but
well,
yes, go ahead.
But there was a wonderful quotation from Roger Ailes. He gave an interview to a business magazine. I guess he didn't think it would be very widely read. And they said, look, Mr. Ailes, you've sold products and you sold candidates. What's the difference between selling a candidate for president and selling, say, a box of cookies? And Ailes replied, a box of cookies doesn't get down off the shelf, go on Meet the Press, and embarrass you. Meaning in Roger Ailes' world, he would like a candidate as pliable and obedient as a box of cookies. That today is the ideal presidential candidate from the point of view of the handlers.
I often wonder whether the handlers are truly there to handle the candidate or whether they're there actually to handle the press.
Oh, they're there to handle both. You correctly identify that a large part of their job is to not only build an image of the candidate, that's part of it, of course, but then project that image and make sure the media goes with the proper image. And they do that by a very simple method, maybe pioneered by Ronald Reagan, but perfected by George Bush, which is to pick one message. It can be anything. It could be Willie Horton. It could be the pledge to the flag. It could be the environment. It could be crime. You pick one message for one day, and that is all you talk about. And then you keep your candidate away from the press so the press can't ask him questions about anything else.
Well, the 1988 campaign was famous for several things. Of course, the Willie Horton ad, and I think even Michael Dukakis riding around in a tank. That's a kind of image that has lasted. And also the question that was asked to candidate Gary Hart, had he ever committed adultery? And do you think questions like that have a place in a presidential campaign? Is this something that the public needs to know?
I think there's certainly going to be part of presidential campaigns forevermore, unless the candidates get smarter about how they handle their personal lives. For some candidates, what is curious about the whole adultery question in 1988 was not just that it was asked about Gary Hart, but that about some candidates the press did not want an answer. It was asked to Jesse Jackson and his wife, Jackie, and there had been rumors for years. I am not revealing anything on the radio today. It has been in print. There were rumors for years that Jesse Jackson had relationships with women other than his wife. And this was asked in a press conference, and Jackie, his wife, responded. She said to the press, "Look, if you find out anything about my husband, I don't want to hear it, and I don't want you to print it, because I have children and I have a family, and I don't want our dirty sheets aired in public."
But what difference does it make if someone is having an affair? Does that truly reveal something about their presidential character?
I think it does, and I may be in a minority on this. To me, adultery is a question of honesty. It breaks faith with one's spouse. I know this sounds horribly old-fashioned on my part, but I think if the American public wishes to ignore adultery, then they should have that choice. They should know about it and decide, heck, I don't mind if Gary Hart did it. And I wrote at the time, I don't think Gary Hart should have ever gotten out of the race. I think he very foolishly allowed the press to run him out of the race. If I had been he at that press conference, I would have said, I did it. I'm not proud of it. Now let's go on to more serious subjects in the presidential campaign. I'll bet he would have done much better with that answer than the answer he gave.
You have a chapter, it's actually a talk with an anonymous woman who had a brief affair with Senator Gary Hart. I'm curious why you included this chapter. First of all, she is anonymous. Gary Hart is now a private citizen. Does that tell us anything more both about the presidential campaign and about Gary Hart himself?
Well, first of all, Gary Hart, I think, is no more a private citizen than any man who has run for president twice, and in his case, three times, since he ran twice in 1988 alone.
So he can never be a private citizen?
Oh, I'm not saying never, but it's unlikely. I mean, in his dotage, perhaps he will be a private citizen. But and he is certainly, do not count him out for future races. He is not counting himself out. He could run as early as 1992 and quite possibly in 1996. I don't like anonymous interviews. It's the only anonymous interview in the book. I did it simply because it was the interview is of a highly personal nature. It's not a salacious chapter. It is a chapter that reveals, I think, important things about Gary Hart's character.
Well, for me, it revealed both. I wasn't sure exactly whether to interpret as a kind of arrogance because he didn't hide anything, or whether it was a kind of naivete on his part to be so public about his interest and his relationship with this woman, which was short-lived. It didn't seem to last a particularly long time.
I think it's both, and I think arrogance coupled with naivete is one of the, a great fatality for presidential candidates. He had the arrogance to believe that the press would give him the same pass it had given former world leaders. And he had the naivete to believe, I think, that things would not change, that when the press had the smoking gun, or pretty close to a smoking gun, that they would not somehow go with it. I think the other thing it reveals is that sex was not the motivation for Gary Hart. The woman gave me the interview not because she wanted to get back at Gary Hart, quite the opposite. She thought and thinks to this day that the chapter makes him look good, and it's interesting how people react to it. I just had another reporter tell me that what he learned about it was that Gary Hart wanted to be mothered, and that when he later dropped these women, as he always did, none of them reacted with anger, because we all know that the people we mother will grow up and leave home someday. So it's interesting the different reads people get out of that on Gary Hart's character.
My guest today is Roger Simon. His syndicated column originates at the Baltimore Sun. Simon's book looks back on the 1988 presidential election, and it's entitled Roadshow. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Roger Simon. He's a columnist at the Baltimore Sun and author of the new book, Roadshow. How much was George Bush haunted by the, quote-unquote, wimp image during the 1988 campaign?
It had an enormous effect on him personally, on his family, and it had an enormous effect, an underestimated effect, on the campaign itself. My book opens with the day that George Bush is going to announce for the presidency in 1987. It happens to be the exact day that the Newsweek cover appears with his picture on it and the headline, Fighting the Wimp Factor.
Wasn't it a question mark?
No, it did indeed have a question mark.
Okay.
And Wimp Factor was in single quotations to indicate that Newsweek wasn't calling him a wimp, but that others were. It's the kind of thing that print journalists find very significant and no one else can even remember.
But he took those as fighting words, yes?
Oh, he was absolutely... Before he got up his fighting spirit, he was crushed. Ailes shows up at his hotel room at 5 in the morning because he has to prep Bush to go on the morning TV shows and begin this tremendous winding staircase to the presidency. And the Secret Service agent is at the door shaking his head and says, you know, it's pretty bad. You better go in there. And Ailes walks in, and there's Bush in his bathrobe, unshaven, with the Newsweek magazine cover down on the floor beneath his feet because he can't even stand looking at that word. And I wrote a column at the time saying, you know, of all the things you want to accuse George Bush of doing wrong in his life, and I listed a number of them, wimp is a bad term, and it's a bad image, and criticize the guy if you want, but what we should be concerned about is not converting our candidates into phony, macho, tough guys who are going to send Marines to Beirut to prove they're not wimps.
Well, George Bush is a man that hunts, he plays tennis, he fishes, he golfs, all like in the space of one morning. Is this the behavior of a wimp?
No, but as we all know, image is much more important than reality. And what had reduced him to a wimp, a word he could not even write. After I wrote the column on him, he wrote me a little note on his vice presidential stationery, and he referred to the W-dash-dash-dash word. He could not even bring himself to dictate it to his secretary or to have anyone type it in print. But George Bush's self-image, that of a two-fisted outdoors man. And after all, he was a war hero. He was the youngest naval aviator in the history of World War II. Right after prep school, he volunteered and went to the South Pacific, won a very distinguished medal, shot down a bunch of enemy planes, et cetera, et cetera. But in 8 years of being vice president, he had been reduced to what George Will called the lapdog.
Doesn't this happen to many vice presidents?
It does indeed. But many vice presidents don't then choose to run for president and have to stand on their own 2 feet. And in the Reagan White House, of course, Bush was in no way an equal partner. I mean, he was kept very much in the shadows. And now, overnight, he had to emerge from that wimp image. And his handlers used that. They not only built him a new image, the image you speak of now, the outdoorsman, the guy who likes to go out in the speedboat, the guy who likes to toss horseshoes, the guy who likes to eat pork rinds, the regular guy that we not only want to send to the White House, but we want to go to the prom with him. They not only sold that image to the American people, but they used the hurt of the wimp campaign to manipulate Bush. They would go to him and say, George, you got to really be negative. You got to really bash Bob Dole in New Hampshire. You got to really bash Pete DuPont at the first debate. You got to really unleash this Willie Horton campaign against Michael Dukakis, because every time you bash somebody, people will know you're not a wimp.
So in part, you're saying that explains the viciousness of the 1988 campaign. It appears to have worked.
It did appear to work. And at every juncture that I've just mentioned, except the last one, Willie Horton, the press not only did not criticize George Bush for it, they applauded him for it. Attacking your opponent really worked in 1988. After the campaign, I asked Lee Atwater, Bush's campaign manager and now chairman of the Republican Party, what was the strategy of the campaign? He says, there are only two strategies. Build up your opponent's negatives and control the media. And Bush did that better than anyone else. And he not only won the primaries, he won the presidency.
He had a candidate, though, that did not fight back, who seemed to feel it was beneath him to fight back.
I'm not so sure that's true. I am not a great subscriber to the theory of if only we had fought back earlier, Mike Dukakis would have done better. As a matter of fact, if you go through the clips and the record, Mike Dukakis struck back pretty quickly. The big trouble was that the issue that really devastated Mike Dukakis, more than any other issue, was the Willie Horton issue. And that raised what Jesse Jackson accurately termed certain psychosexual fears in the American public, this hulking, vicious black man who breaks into the home of a white couple and tortures the man and rapes and tortures the woman. The trouble with responding to that issue for Mike Dukakis was he had nothing to say. I interviewed his handlers at the time, and they got so frustrated at being told they weren't answering George Bush's attack. One of them shoved a piece of paper at me across the restaurant table one night and took out a pen and said, "Okay, wise guy, you write the 30-second ad that responds to that issue. You write the 30-second ad that said Mike Dukakis didn't let Willie Horton out of prison." The fact is, it was one of those nightmare issues that tends to haunt chief executives. He was chief executive of Massachusetts. George Bush, who had never been a chief executive, lacked those kind of issues and lacked points upon which he could be attacked.
My guest is Roger Simon. He's a columnist at the Baltimore Sun and author of the new book, Roadshow. Let's talk about George Bush as president. And I must say, until recently, he looked like a very happy president. And perhaps these were just all the photo opportunities that we saw. But he looks like he's having the time of his life.
He doesn't look that way today,
no,
I assure
doesn't.
You.
He doesn't. And a recent New York Times CBS poll has demonstrated, and other polls have demonstrated as well, that his popularity has dropped from 76% to 60%, and this is from August until October. What is happening then to George Bush, the leader, the president?
What is happening to George Bush and to America, to all of us, is that we are paying the price for the way in which we elect our presidents. It's my contention that we as Americans take more real time and effort to buy a new car, to select a new car, than to select a new president. And the reason we have paralysis on Capitol Hill today and in the White House today is because the leaders of Congress know that George Bush wasn't elected for any set of discernible reasons. He has no mandate from the American people to cut the deficit, to raise taxes, to cut spending, et cetera, et cetera. Newt Gingrich, the Republican House Whip, a member of George Bush's party, knows that he can thumb his nose at the president because in his home district in Georgia, he knows that George Bush has no great popularity in terms of specific issues. And until the day comes when we start electing presidents for specific reasons instead of non-reasons like we like the guy and we hate the other guy, we're not going to get presidents who have mandates for change.
Well, let me ask you something, because George Bush campaigned on the slogan, "Read my lips, no new taxes." Now what we're asked to do is to read his hips. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but he seems to be both mocking himself and mocking the people who voted for him by this kind of glib little phrase that's now being touted around.
I think he is genuinely adrift. What it is that you see a man undergoing a transition from candidate to president. And the same one-liners that you could toss off as president in a campaign take on a great importance and now I think create a disquieting feeling on the part of the American public to see a leader who isn't particularly leading. The other factor is, of course, that the handlers of George Bush were important to him. And his chief handler, his chief political handler, Lee Atwater, is recovering from a brain tumor and is not on the job 100%. And that contributes to the drift.
Newsweek talks about the Carterization of Bush, and they use that phrase, and I'll quote, weakened to the point of ridicule. And they also make the case that that Bush is facing some of the same problems that Carter faced, which is recession, rising oil prices, and hostages. Do you see this quote-unquote Carterization going on?
I think that's a little unfair to both parties, although there's an element of truth in it. Jimmy Carter faced those problems because he could not control events because, in fact, the Ayatollah Khomeini controlled events. He took American hostages. He held them. There was an oil embargo. And it was very tough to near impossibility for Jimmy Carter to do anything about that. Had those events not happened, I wouldn't be so sure Jimmy Carter wouldn't have won a second term. George Bush is much more in control of events. Yes, he faces Saddam Hussein, and yes, Saddam Hussein has hostages, sort of, but our attitude toward hostages has shifted. George Bush has made clear that, unlike even Ronald Reagan, he's not about to bargain for hostages, and he's not about to sell arms to Iraq to get them back. George Bush has taken the first steps to take a dynamic, positive set of steps in the Mideast to avoid becoming Jimmy Carter. Now we're sort of bogged down in this tremendous sitzkrieg. The trouble comes not overseas, but at home. Nobody is in control of the American economy, and that is the real crusher for George Bush. I don't think Saddam Hussein is capable of defeating George Bush in 1992. I think the economy is.
The subtitle of your book is, In America, Anyone Can Become Presidents. It's one of the risks that we take. Do you really think anyone can become president, assuming they would want it?
Well, I think you'd have to take a look back at who we have elected. George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Richard Nixon, and Lyndon Baines Johnson, and ask yourself if that famous saying by Adlai Stevenson is more true than false. As long as we give the process over so completely to professional image makers, and as long as we so enjoy the roadshow itself without pulling back the curtain and peeking behind the scenes to see how we're really electing people, just about anyone who can put together the right handlers can become president of the United States, and I would use as my proof exactly the people we've elected.
Roger Simon, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Roger Simon. He writes a nationally syndicated column at the Baltimore Sun. His new book on the 1988 presidential election is called Roadshow. Next time, we'll have a concert with British vocalist June Tabor. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Here's June Tabor singing Finisterre.
Farewell, Finisterre. Sleep away the afternoon, rocking with the tide, drinking with the moon. I found a ticket in my pocket, pulled away from Port of Spain, and a warm wind from the Indies covered me again.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air.
Ching, 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 ding, ching, ching. Ching, 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 ding, ching, ching.
More Brazilian music coming up on Fresh Air. Our world music critic Milo Miles will review a collection of songs by João Gilberto, one of the pioneers of the bossa nova. As a child, Ruth Sadransky was the link between her deaf parents and the speaking world. And as she grew up, she discovered that her own speech had a sound that was influenced by growing up in a deaf household. Coming up on Fresh Air, living in between the worlds of the deaf and the hearing. It's the 50th anniversary of Fantasia, Disney's classic animated film, and Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Se o bem que lhe disse, olha essa embrulhada em que vou me meter. Agora, amor, Doralice, meu bem.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Canoy. El Salvador's military is on the alert in the capital today following a rebel attack on the country's main military base overnight. NPR's Tom Gibb reports that the attack produced more noise than heavy fighting.
The rebels fired homemade mortars and catapult bombs into the airbase from nearby houses. Helicopter gunships and Air Force planes rocketed and strafed. In other parts of the city, machine gun fire broke out briefly. But for all the noise, there were no reports of serious casualties on either side, and the airbase received only minor damage. In comparison to the permanent heavy fighting in the countryside, the attack was more of a skirmish. However, it comes at a time when peace talks have stalemated and the rebels are threatening an offensive to force more government concessions. The army is on full alert. Both sides are also waiting to see if the U.S. Congress will withhold half of El Salvador's military aid. An offensive by the rebels now would cost them dearly in Washington. The National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
Secretary of State James Baker said it would be self-defeating for the Bush administration to promise Congress a role if the U.S. went to war with Iraq. Appearing before the House Foreign Relations Committee today, Baker said to tell lawmakers before the fact could tip off Iraq about military action. Some committee Democrats urge Baker and the president to call on Congress if they think the country needs to go to war. The United Nations Security Council is moving toward a vote on a new resolution that would increase the pressure on Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
Five permanent members of the council have been ironing out a resolution that would make Saddam Hussein responsible for what it calls the rape and pillage of Kuwait. Diplomatic sources say the resolution would demand that Iraq compensate Kuwait and other countries, as well as the citizens of those countries who have suffered losses. It insists that Baghdad stop preventing vital supplies, such as food and water, from reaching diplomats in Kuwait. States are directed to keep records of their losses in the hope that Iraq may one day be forced to make restitution. While the proposal lacks the immediate power to force payments from Baghdad, it opens the door to further action, such as seizing Iraqi assets abroad. The council is expected to begin the debate tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The Arab League unanimously condemned Israel today for the Temple Mount killings of 21 Palestinians, but the 21 members split over a bid by Iraq and the PLO to also denounce the United States. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 65 points to 2452.72. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Fantasia, the movie, is 50 years old and has just been re-released. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review a little later in the show. A new album of reissued music from Brazil has inspired world music commentator Milo Miles to delve into the history of one hybrid musical style. He says that back in the 60s, it was the hippest and the most sophisticated pop music around.
Você disser que eu desafio amor, saiba que isto em mim provoca imensa dor. Só privilegiados têm ouvido igual ao seu. Eu possuo apenas o que Deus me deu.
That little tune is Desafinado, the cornerstone of bossa nova, and still catchy after 30 years. The creamy tone singer is guitarist João Gilberto, who became the first and most influential bossa nova star in Brazil. Desafinado is by Antonio Carlos Jobim, the king of bossa nova songwriters. In the late 50s, Gilberto and Jobim were young Hepcat pals and also ardent fans of the California style of cool jazz. The two friends went to work on a mainstay of Brazilian pop, the samba, and fused it with cool jazz by stripping away polyrhythms and expanding the melodic harmonies. In Desafinado, the new music was named Bossa Nova, which means something like new wave. Of course, since Bossa Nova was a combination of jazz and samba, it was easy to add more jazz to the equation. Stan Getz and Charlie Bird did just that to Desafinado and had a big hit themselves in 1962. In Brazil, bossa nova became a favorite of the upwardly mobile middle class. It was so cosmopolitan, so chicly reserved. Strangely enough, the music caught on in much the same way in the United States, and for several years in the mid-60s, it was bossa nova everything. Jobim's song, The Girl from Ipanema, hit the top 10 in a version sung by João Gilberto's wife, Astrud, and Edie Gourmet enjoyed the biggest score of her solo career with Blame It on the Bossa Nova. Most Brazilian bossa novas were more subtle than that. A particularly fascinating one by Gilberto is Samba de Una Nota So, the one-note samba, which does indeed stay on one note for the first lines, then moves to a scale, but returns to the one note. Gilberto declares he comes back to it just like he has to come back to his girlfriend.
Eis aqui este sambinha feito numa nota só. Outras notas vão entrar, mas a base é uma só. Esta outra é consequência do que acabo de dizer. Como eu sou a consequência inevitável de você. Quanta gente existe por aí que fala tanto e não diz nada, ou quase nada. Já me utilizei de toda a escala, no final não sobrou nada. Não deu em nada e voltei pra minha nota. Como eu volto pra você, vou contar com a minha nota. Como eu gosto de você.
Even so, some folks were blaming things on the bossa nova. Nationalists in Brazil denounced it as a foreign corruption of native traditions, but that's a standard complaint about any inventive world music. For me, the deeper problem with bossa nova is that it's so frightfully tasteful all the time. It's about the most genteel pop I can recommend wholeheartedly. The number Bim Bum is as worked up as Gilberto ever gets, and he just barely cracks a sweat.
Bim bum, bim bim bum, bim bum, bim bum, bim bum. Bim bum, bim bim bum, bim bum, bim bum, bim bim. É só isso, meu baião. E não tem mais nada não. O meu coração pediu assim. Só bim bom, bim 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 bom.
As the Beatles' rock and roll displaced bossa nova in the US, it did the same in Brazil and gave rise to a much harder, more aggressive music with explicitly political themes. Performers were putting back all the tough drum beats bossa nova had taken out. But there's no reason to consider bossa nova a quaint, forgotten antique, not when a new lavish collection called the legendary João Gilberto is around. This includes all of Gilberto's first three records, plus two unreleased tracks, for a whopping 38 cuts in all, a bossa nova supernova. Gilberto makes for enormously pleasant company, and if his spidery guitar and well-mannered voice can turn wispy at times, he's also one of the top tender hearts in pop and a sublime sufferer. Here he is at his best, wounded but unbowed, in the song So Insensitive.
Ah, insensatez que você fez, coração mais sem cuidado, fez chorar de dor o seu amor, um amor tão delicado. Ah, porque você
foi fraco assim, assim tão desalmado. Ah, meu coração, quem nunca amou não merece ser amado.
Milo Miles reviewed the legendary João Gilberto. It's on the World Pacific label.
Vai, meu coração, ouve a razão, usa só sinceridade.
This is Fresh Air. Sadransky grew up as a hearing child with deaf parents. It was the deaf community that embraced her and the silence of her parents' apartment that made her feel part of a large extended family. But Ruth Sadransky's hearing let her live in two worlds, the one of her parents and their friends, and the one where she existed on her own. In Silence is her memoir of growing up in the Bronx during the 1930s and 40s. Ruth Sadransky told me that because her parents were deaf, the parent-child roles in her family were reversed. She had to assume the more adult role with her parents because she often spoke for them to the outside world.
I was what is known classically as the parentified child. There was definitely a role reversal. And I took care of them in terms of being their interpreter out in the wide world. So it was very, very much a lonely childhood, a separate childhood, but a very, very loved childhood. I was adored by my parents.
You describe the deaf community of your parents creating their own world for themselves, a world that really excluded the hearing world. Was it just the kind of language barrier, or was it based on a kind of snobbery? Because your father even had some kind of nasty remarks about hearing people. He called them stupid at times.
No, I don't think it was snobbery. The word, the operative word here is fear. They were afraid, and still are, some deaf are still afraid of walking boldly into the hearing world. It's very difficult for them to communicate with a hearing person who has no knowledge of the limited language a deaf person has, even a very well-educated deaf person today. It had nothing whatever to do with snobbery. They never excluded the hearing world. They wanted to be part of it, but were afraid of it.
Before you went off to school, what was your speech like, and how well could you express yourself in the hearing world? Could people understand you?
No. I could express myself fluently in sign language. There was no problem at home. But in the street, I spoke some words like normal children. Mm-hmm. I spoke some words like my mother or my father spoke. But for example, the word tomato, very simple word, my mother would say it, Domado. Now that nobody would understand me if I said that. And that really was D-O-M-A-D-A-E. So it was very difficult. So I would have some words that were perfectly intelligible to the ear and some words that were not. So when I spoke in this mixed, garbled confusion of speech, people looked at me like I was weird.
When you went to school, your first day of school, they put you in a class for mentally retarded children. Who did they think you were?
I have no idea. I have no idea. But that was really a horror for me.
You were very excited about the prospect of going to school.
Yes, my father promised me that school would really educate me. School would give me language, and I would learn to hear it. I mean, he thought that language was the greatest gift on this earth.
And what was this class like compared to what your father had painted for you?
Dreadful, because I remember very clearly we had crayons, and we drew pictures and we played, but I didn't learn anything. And my mother was very wise, and she noticed that I was very depressed. I blurted it out in hands, not in bath.
Right.
That I was in school for stupid children. My mother took me to school and marched me into the principal's office and insisted that the principal speak to her. The principal wanted to write notes. My mother said no. She crouched down and kneeled to me and said to me in sign language, you speak for me. And then she said, turn to the principal, and in voice, one of the clearest sentences I ever heard her say, Ruth speaks for me.
Hmm.
And I interpreted for my mother, I don't remember the exact conversation, but I do remember the principal telling my mother to get me a radio.
An interesting recommendation, and one that it seems rather creative to me.
It was. It's interesting because we couldn't afford to buy the radio, and I remember my father telling me that was really a hardship for them. It was 25 cents a week for I don't know how many years.
How did, though, the radio transform your life?
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, there was magic, another form of magic, another form of language. It came into my house, and I heard people speaking real voices. And I used to think to myself, oh, that's how you say that word in real language. Because I knew how to say it in deaf, but not, or sign language. And I always thought of sign language as deaf. I never thought of it as sign language as a child.
What kind of education did your parents have?
My mother went to school at the Lexington School for the Deaf in New York City until she was in the eighth grade, I believe. And my father went until he was the fifth or sixth grade. He went until he was about 14, but he was left back several times. For him, it was really a tragedy because he didn't learn anything until he was six or seven. Sign language was forbidden, and it's almost impossible to lip read. It's really an art, and not everybody can understand that.
And I assume that your parents, the part of the education was to make them speak.
Yes. Sign language was forbidden. Children were roundly smacked with a very large wooden ruler. And so when they sign in secret. And my father really didn't learn a signed word until he was 12 or 13. He once asked me who was the best writer in the world. And I happened to have Mark Twain, and I read a paragraph, half a page. It broke my heart. He really didn't understand.
Hmm. Well, you say about your father that, and this is really a quote, that his intelligence was locked away, that somehow he got separated from his own wit. And yet you also describe a very passionate man, a man who seemed to also love language and expressiveness at the same time.
Yes, but I really do believe that if language comes as late as it did to my father, that it's like a childhood lost. You really don't recover. Children really learn to speak from the ages of, let's say, 23 months to 36 months. If language isn't really established at that time, any linguist will tell you, any pediatrician will tell you, it's almost impossible for them to recover. And he never really recovered from that. His intelligence was locked away. And he did, by sheer will and sheer force, learn many things. But he never learned the continuing flow of language as we know it in our kind of speech, whether in normal speaking pattern or in reading a book. He could not even sustain a comic book.
And you say about your mother that over time she kind of lost her curiosity about language.
She had enough of school. She had enough of language. She had something else. She had sight. She could look at something or someone and know immediately who they were, what their personality was, whether they were kind or unkind, whether they were mean or stingy. So she didn't miss much, I must tell you that. Not very much. I mean, she knew when I was happy or when I was sad. I also knew when she was happy or sad. Without speech, she would come to me if I was reading or studying when I was in high school or college. She put her hand on my shoulder to catch my attention. And I knew by the pressure of her fingers what her mood would be. And that's the kind of sensitivity she had that she imparted to me. It was really remarkable.
You say that deaf hands are wonderful.
Oh, they are. Absolutely marvelous.
What do they know that I don't know, you don't know, hearing people don't know?
Well, my father used to tell me that if you're hearing and you have to hear speech, and this was his perception, that you have to wait until the sound reaches your ears, and you might not be able to understand what the person was really saying from his heart. But a deaf person must use facial, spatial speech. It's really body language, if you like.
Do you notice hands? Do you notice even hearing people, how they use their hands?
The first thing I see. Interesting. I see first the hands, and then I see their eyes. I always see.
And how do hands give us away?
Well, some people will clasp the hands, and some people put their arms across their chest. Some people will make little fists with the hands when they talk. Some people will have the hands open on a table. Some people will have them face down on a table. And I have picked up many clues about people that I had to deal with over the years from the way they held their hands. And I never, ever thought of that until you just asked me just now.
Do you dream in sign language? And, I mean, I guess it's hard to know if one sleeps by oneself, whether one does this or not, but whether, and even, I guess, deaf people, whether they do dream in sign language.
Well, I know my father dreamed in sign language. I don't dream in sign language, not that I know of, but I know that my father did. I would watch him have a nap. He would smile, and his hands would be flying, but I never understood him. And when I woke him up, or when he awakened by himself, "What was that you were saying, Pop?" And he would say, "None of your business, not for little girls." And that was the end of that.
You have a story about your mother, and she thought that a yellow tulip had a sound, that color had sound. What did you say to her the sound of yellow was?
It's like the morning sun melting ice. She loved that. And then she said to me, "Tell me the truth. Does the yellow flower really have a sound?" "No, Mom," I said. And she said, "Aw, I knew that. But I'd like to think it had a sound."
Ruth Sedransky, I thank you very much for talking with us today.
And I thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Ruth Sedransky's book is called In Silence, Growing Up Hearing in a Deaf World.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and host Robert Siegel has joined us today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we have news of the U.S. Senate debating a budget deficit reduction plan, and also a report from the town of Easton, Maryland. It's on Chesapeake Bay. And in Easton, there's a plan that's created some controversy on the local school board. The idea is, in light of the levels of teenage sexual activity, to give kids who are sexually active condoms at the school nurse's office if they first engage in a little bit of counseling. That plan has generated quite a debate among some parents who say that the schools should be teaching values and abstinence instead of safe sex.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Walt Disney's movie Fantasia is 50 years old this year and is back in the movie theaters. The original negative and soundtrack have been restored and enhanced. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
That's how it all began, with the music for Paul Dukas' orchestral scherzo, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Walt Disney was trying to revive the public's interest in his biggest star, Mr. Mickey Mouse. And at a Hollywood party, he met the formidable Philadelphia Orchestra conductor, Leopold Stokowski. Together, they decided to make a Mickey Mouse short out of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Only Stokowski didn't want to stop there. Why not, he wondered, make an animated feature-length film with several other musical works all set to whatever Disney animations the music suggested? The result would be a free-form, fanciful composition, a Fantasia, to use the musical term for it. And so it was. Fantasia, which Disney thought of as a profound work of art, was released in 1940, and it was an almost instant flop. The public just plain wasn't interested. Classical music was classical music. It was highbrow, sissy stuff, even with Mickey Mouse and dancing mushrooms and ravening dinosaurs attached. The public was wrong, of course. Fantasia isn't highbrow, not by a long shot. In its new, brightly restored version, It's a wacko combination of the delicious and the unspeakably junky. A fascinating curiosity, and well worth seeing for that reason alone. What's junky about it? Begin with the music. Bach wrote his Toccata and Fugue in D minor for the mighty organ, but Stokowski has his orchestra play it, using Stokowski's own celebrated but rather feeble transcription. He cuts short Beethoven's Pastorale Symphony and plays it chaotically. And even in Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, well, listen to a bit of the slow, anemic-sounding Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. Can't we crank that old Victrola a little higher? Igor Stravinsky found the butchery made of his Rite of Spring appalling. He called the musical performance execrable, and then added, "I will say nothing about the visual compliment, as I do not wish to criticize an unresisting imbecility." Actually, the Rite of Spring section is kind of neat. No, it has nothing to do with Stravinsky's original pagan vision. Disney and his animators have recast it as a kind of grade school history of the Earth, from just after the Big Bang through the Age of the Dinosaurs. The Mickey Mouse Sorcerer's Apprentice is even better, and the famous ballet for hippos, ostriches, and alligators, all done to Ponchielli's Cornball Dance of the Hours, is pure bliss. In fact, the less serious the music is, the more delightful the kitsch Disney has devised to illustrate it. In a way, Disney had no idea what he was doing. When he says we're going to look at some abstract animation inspired by Bach, what we get instead are marching violin bows and glorious sunsets. By abstract, what he really seems to have meant was arty. And the most gonzo section of the movie is Disney's use of the Beethoven Pastorale to illustrate a coy romp among the most all-American-looking boy and girl centaurs imaginable. It's like date night at Mythology High. When Disney finally saw the Pastorale section completed, he responded in a way that summarizes the entertainingly mixed-up nature of the whole movie. "Gee," he said, awestruck, "this'll make Beethoven."
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Vablaitis, and Dan Lachlan. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller, directed today by Roberta Shorrock. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, folk singer June Tabor joins us in our studios for a concert performance. And South African writer Nadine Gordimer talks about her new novel and about the current political situation in her country. That and more next time on Fresh Air.